Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the July 22nd edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The corn and the soybean markets settled the week, get this, nearly unchanged. We'll ask why today on Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Our panelists in studio today include Matt Bennett. He's a TGM in Windsor, Illinois. Dell Durkles of AgriVisor from Bloomington, Illinois. And Jackie Vakes at Stuart Peterson in Champaign, Illinois. Let's open today's discussion with this question. Matt Bennett, why did the corn basis widen in parts of the Midwest this week?
Well, we were talking about this a little bit before the show, and you know, we talked a little bit about the fact that we're going to be transitioning from the cash to the fall, and I think that's part of the reason why. We also have to look at, regionally speaking, this is going to happen because, you know, some of our elevators haven't really seen much of a basis change, and some of the areas that we deal with, we haven't seen the basis change quite as much as maybe Decatur has. So I think a lot of it is a function of where you're at and who needs the corn the worst.
Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson.
Well, I agree with Matt. I think that some of this might just be a relationship, too, to the changeover from the July contract to the September contract. And as we transition into new crop, you're going to see these. I think one of the things, too, is early in the week we had strong numbers. We had very good numbers. We were back up close to $7 again on new crop corn. And old crop corn, when you're talking about a very strong basis level, tends to bring some corn out of the country. So it in places where it widened, they maybe have enough for right at the moment.
And Dale Durkles of AgriVisor.
You know, it really is a combination of both of those. And I think, you know, the one thing that probably magnified some of the changes we're seeing here at this point. I also have to step back and look at the changing weather forecast we had this last week. And that impacts how farmers perceive the market, too. And where you have these big premiums for old crop to the pervading futures right now, that's really going to tend to stimulate occasionally, you know, some movement. But it is going to be kind of a spot regional thing. But we're in that early process, and we're going to see this over the next 45 days.
September corn this week had a high of 723.5, a low at 670.75. The settlement price was down 11.25 for the September at $6.90. December futures up just a half a cent at $6.85.25. Did the less than volatile change from week to week, did that surprise you as we hit Friday afternoon?
You mean the less than volatile change in the DEES contract?
That's right, the weekly change.
Not really. You know, this goes back into markets that I remember back in the 1970s and even in the early 80s, you know, the classic weather markets. And you could see it unfold on a day-by-day basis. We came in on Monday and everybody was, it looks like we're going to be warm and dry and we got some real issues. And along comes late Tuesday, Wednesday, and all of a sudden those evaporate. Now it's going to cool off a little bit and we're going to get a little wetter, and we played with that for a couple of days. We're going to have a lot of this chatter back and forth, but you come into the game on a Friday, you got this anxiousness. Do I really carry a position over a weekend? And so you have this hesitancy in the marketplace one way or another, and I think that's part of the game. The other interesting twist here, in the whole 1.25 rally off the lows we had back in June, we really haven't changed corn open interest that much. That's an interesting twist.
And what does that tell you about the marketplace?
Well, it just tells you, you know, basically what we're seeing is there's a lot of activity on a daily basis, but you have people who are day trading coming in and out of the market all the time. The big players or the players who are there for the long term aren't leaving.
Were the speculators in the funds in very much this week, do you think? I had one analyst tell me during the week this week that they were on the sidelines, that they were watching what was happening in Greece and other parts of the world, and that they were not willing to play in the commodity markets.
Well, I mean, I guess everything that I saw, I didn't see a large presence, but I think they're kind of waiting and seeing. And it's kind of like what Jackie said. Right now, with the volatility that you see, you know, I think that maybe they're a little bit hesitant, probably just to jump right out, partially because of this weather market, this impending weather market that could really make things even more explosive if we go ahead and we extend this ridge.
You know, one issue you have with the hedge funds, we call them today, is their trading's driven in by a large part by computer algorithms. And with the volatility we've put into this, you know, their big buys and sells are either a long way below the market or a long way above the market. So we're seeing them trade in the midst in here, but we aren't going to see them play in a big way in here unless this market really settles into a trend again.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, that's bothering the market in general is the U.S. debt situation and this debt ceiling. When we once get the debt ceiling straightened out, this week we saw gold go above 1,600 all the way out to December 12th. We saw the U.S. dollar trade positive more than it traded negative. You know, the outside traders who come in here with money are just waiting. You can imagine they don't just trade in our markets; they trade everywhere. And so, if perhaps we would default, this could be a very serious situation for them. So, I don't think they're willing to step out too far.
What do you think, Jackie? And I'll stay with you, and the other two can jump in on this. What do you think would happen if Washington D.C. does not get to the point where that appears that they're really, and we're probably close to being there at this point, that they're going to make some kind of move, and the default becomes imminent, or that it may look like it's going to happen to the marketplace?
Well, I think you could see a tsunami effect. You know, when you talk about the U.S., we have probably the best rating that there is. We're the world currency. It has implications for everything from crude oil all the way across to the banking situations. That's why in my heart of hearts, I don't believe it's going to happen.
If we get to a point where it looks like a default's going to happen, money comes off the table and comes off the table in a big way because you're flying into a blind abyss and nobody knows, and risk will be a huge dirty word. If we go to default, it's a huge bear potentially, you know, for the short term.
I wholeheartedly agree with what these guys say. I mean, you know, we've talked about if the funds all decide to try to get out the door at the same time, there's not a big enough door for it to happen. And I think in more markets than just what we're talking about today, that could be the case where you would see a max exodus, which would be extremely volatile and ultimately a bearish situation.
You know, when you get into these environments, the big game is trying to preserve capital. It's not about making money anymore. It's just like during the Depression back in the 30s, the people that made money really didn't make a lot of money. They just preserved what they had. And if it looks like we're going into a default, you know, that's where big money looks at. I'm going to do anything I can to preserve my capital. I'm not worried today about making money.
Right. And I think that you have to, you know, you have to take that and bring that back to our producer level. And at the producer level, this is why they've got a plan for if the market goes higher, if the market goes lower, if circumstances change. So, you know, at the producer level, you've got to have that same type of plan. And the whole thing is about preserving equity.
Well, I made a phone call earlier in the week, and I didn't get a chance to have him on the air, but I think we will shortly. Did anybody read the article from Murray Wise this week that said the land values are not a bubble? And do you believe that at $11,000 and $12,000 an acre?
I think that land values, I'm a little hesitant to go out and buy it at $11,000 or $12,000, but on the other hand, I don't see it going away readily. I don't see it going away for a couple of reasons. There's such a large demand just for protein in this world, and it's not going away. And I don't feel like good quality farmland, we all know they're not making any more of it. And I've said all along, I guess my personal opinion on the matter is that whenever I'm retirement age, the landowner is going to be sitting in a pretty good situation in the U.S.
Well, I agree, and I think when you also look at the competitive situation for land, we're not only talking about farmer to farmer competition for land anymore. We're talking about hedge fund competition for land. We're talking about big corporation, you know. So the likelihood of us, I don't believe there's a bubble either at this stage, you know, but that doesn't mean you don't have to be careful.
One thing that nobody really thinks about, and one thing they do need to think about, is are land prices impacted by the level of the dollar, the value of the dollar? And there is an indirect correlation there through what happens to the price of commodities, corn or beans or wheat, per se, at this point. If the dollar, for whatever reason, you know, would take off and start running up, assuming we get our debt restructured and the Europeans, for example, wouldn't, and the dollar would take off on a fly, that's a bear ingredient back into the corn market, bean market, wheat market, which in turn, if it lasts long enough, is a depressing effect on land prices. But what Murray said, he didn't believe it was a bubble. I don't think we're in a bubble point yet. Some point we may get there, but I don't think we're yet there yet today.
I agree. And one thing that I've said whenever discussing land, we could talk land prices for 2 hours probably and have a lot of great points. I think if you're looking at the land market, you got to realize it's definitely a cyclical market, just like a lot of other things. It might be cheaper than $12,000 in 3 or 4 years, but it also might be $15,000 in 7 or 8 or 10 years. It's very possible. You know, whenever we hear about $13,000 land sales here, right here close to where we're at right now, that's away from town and not developmental land, to me, it says that it's not out of the question to think that we're going to keep ratcheting this thing up. There's a large demand for land.
Come back to the corn market directly for me. Producers have, I suspect, asked you questions about the marketplace for new crop corn this week. And maybe they're talking to you more about what they think is in their field and what damage is being done. What have you heard?
Well, where we're at, in most of the areas in my neck of the woods have not gotten a lot of rain in the last month, really. And on my drive up here today, I noticed a lot of lawns that were turning brown, quite frankly, and that's not a good sign. And I think most guys are very concerned, but they also realize that if we could get a little abatement of this heat and a shower, a lot can change quickly. These hybrids are much different than they were in years past, and we've seen this in the last few years, a really hot, dry period, and then we go ahead and have some 180, 200 bushel corn, which is still possible. Guys are a little bit worried about going ahead and making sales until we get another rain, and I don't blame them.
When you get outside of the Midwest, what are your clients, for instance, that
it's really amazing. You go to northern Iowa, you've got beautiful crops. You know, and they never really had the stress. I think one of the clients today summed it up pretty well. He said, corn has been under stress since the bag of seed was opened this year. And I'd have to say he's probably very right. When you get into Minnesota, boy, it's spotty. There's some very bad areas. Even in Iowa, there's some very tough areas. I think around here, we first started really seeing the major stress now the last few days, you know, and so we're to the point where we really need rain. But one of the guys on northern Illinois went out into a field that was done pollinating. And this is the thing I think the trade is missing. It's one thing to have heat when you're filling after you've had good pollination, but it's another thing to have this heat during pollination. And when he went out, he said it made him sick and he's a guy that I believe. He said he had blisters and then absolutely big areas of no blisters, and then a few blisters, and then no blisters at all. And he said, I checked the number of cobs, and I walked out and said, I'm not going out into my other fields. I just don't want to look. So, we're going to go from one extreme to the next. Just depends upon if you got any rain.
You know, I think that's the one key that we're all real uncertain about in the modern-day hybrids. You know, how do we manage, and how do the hybrids handle heat? You know, when I go back, I can think of 2 years in history where we had heat. One of those was 95. And about this early July, we got, for about 4 days, 95 to a little over 100 degrees in the Midwest. And we had poor pollination. The other one was 1983. But we haven't had a period where we've had high heat at pollination over a broad area during at this particular point in time. And so we don't know how modern hybrids are going to handle it. The other thing that's a little different, in 95 and also in 83, when we were hot during pollination, we also had warm, dry winds. This one, we've got high humidity, which tends to at least help the plant a little bit in the evapotranspiration process. So, you know, we're going to have instances, but I think the pollination thing is one thing that's going to really be important. And you know, that's the one thing on the USDA report in August we still won't have a clue about.
I was going to ask that question. Will we catch, when will we be able to catch that? Will it be the September report or later?
September, the first time the USDA really starts looking at the ears themselves, really becomes a September report. August is basically a population count report.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this year ProFarmer will be the first window that we'll get to look, and that's not until the 22nd of August.
But Doan's, always Doan's. They make a tour of the Midwest.
Oh, they do, that's right.
The 1st of August, before the August USDA report, and I think really trying to find out what they uncover in terms of pollination that they see on a broad basis might be rather interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Does a farmer need to stand aside the marketplace and wait it out?
Well, you know, it all depends on where they're at as far as their sales go, and it all depends on what their comfort level is as far as option strategies go, because there could be some real opportunities in here. If we come in here on Monday morning and big parts of the Midwest did not get rain that's advertised for Sunday, you know, we could be looking at a pretty dynamic market on Monday, even though we've seen good rains in Iowa and northern Illinois in the last day or two. And I think that if you see that $1.50 run up, which is always possible, you never really know what's going to happen, that would create some interesting opportunities for guys to place some hedge windows into place that might be able to protect them on the bottom side.
You're listening to the July 22nd edition of Commodity Week. More when we return.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the July 22nd edition of Commodity Week. Our panelists in studio include Dale Durkles of AgriVisor, Jackie Vakes of Stewart Peterson, and Matt Bennett from TGM. Here's the way the weekly trade settled for the soybeans. The August contract had a high in the overnight day trade, open outcry and electronic at $14.08. The low at $13.69 3/4, and the August settled $13.80 1/4. It was 5.5 cents lower for the week. November beans at $13.88 1/4, a penny and a quarter higher. Dale Durkles, there is a triple top in the harvest month. Looks like a quadruple top at the moment, I suppose. Is it made to be taken out?
That's the old adage about triple tops. Triple tops are made to be broken, but now we potentially have a quadruple top. I don't know. You know, the beans are really an interesting story when you just look at them from a pure technical point. We have had November beans stuck in a range of 1280 on the bottom side. I think actually the low is 1286 and just over 14 off the top, and we cannot move out of it. We just continue to chop sideways in that particular range. You know, and it's the one that's really perplexing, because beans and or meal are both cheap relative to corn, and meal in particular, you know, you think about that because of the feed demand impact. But yet we can't find the legs to get that market going. So I think you have to be careful. It's the one that, you know, if we walk in here on Monday morning and we have dry weather, it may be the beans that could take off more so even than the corn, because, boy, you get over 14.11 new contract high, and it's going to be in no man's land again.
I agree with it. I agree with Dale on that. I think beans can wait just a little bit longer weather-wise, but I also think we're in such a dire situation in some areas where they haven't even, you know, had maybe a half an inch over the last month, that beans, you know, you got to wonder whether how many blooms we're going to have on these beans. You got to wonder how many pods are going to be set. We're entering a critical time. Corn is almost through with pollination, or what should have been pollination. Unfortunately, some people may not have got fully pollinated, but as far as beans go, we can probably wait just a little bit longer. They do not mind a little bit of dry weather and some heat, but it's getting crunch time. And if we see not only a dry forecast for this next week, but the two-week forecast is hot and dry, and they maybe keep the ridge around a little bit longer, I agree with Dale. We could be looking at some really, really sizable gains next week for beans.
And I think it's interesting, too, when you look back. I've been doing some research looking back to January 1st of 2008. We've been above 14 on a weekly chart 17 times out of 174 weeks. And yet, you know, the contract high from 2008 on November 11 is 1550. There's no reason to think that if we really get into a weather problem in August, you know, that we couldn't take out this top and even look at something, you know, a stretch to try and get to that. If you look at Landworth, which came out today, you know, they came out at 41.3. If you take more than two bushels off on beans for this year and you leave demand the same, we're down to nothing on beans at all. So from an explosive market, that market could just be wild.
That I found most interesting on Friday. Line worth bean yield number and the market didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, and because, you know, you do talk about a 41.3, I think it was, yield, you know, and it is significant, you know, if we're that low. The other thing I will say about line worth, I have a lot of respect for what they're doing, but their yield models still are not real good at picking up some of the things that are actually going on in the field. And, and that's just an evolution of the product they're putting together and developing. It's not really a critique. And like Matt said, it's still early yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I can still, if I come in August and I start seeing decent rains across the Midwest, I can bail out a problem in July in beans and still have a whale of a crop. So I think we're still in this uncertainty phase in here, you know, and that's the real issue. Then it steps back and you think about the other factor is that money just doesn't seem to want to play the game right now anywhere.
Yeah, I think basically in beans, you know, because we haven't had a tremendous amount of buying coming out of China on exports, you know, even with our clients, how many clients do any of us have here who call up and talk about beans all the time? They don't. Everybody's focused on corn. Everything's corn no matter how you look at it. And I think the trade is very much focused that way too. But when you look at Landworth, they always make the mistake. They come out, this is their end of the year number. 41.3. This is not their number like we're looking at with the USDA. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think the trade is not going to look at that much because they're going to say it's too far off, there's too much time, but that's what they're looking. And they have thousands of people down on the ground out on farms because I have clients who have had Landworth's people out there interviewing and walking in fields. So I think there's some credibility there, but at the same time, I look at beans like a weed. They can take pods and drop them. They can put them back on, you know. So that first week in August is going to be the big one.
There's no doubt that it'll be extremely critical what's going to happen, not maybe this next week for beans. This next week is very critical. The next 7 to 10 days is extremely critical for the corn market. It's a make-or-break situation in many areas. As far as beans go, we've probably still got 20 days where we need to get a rain at some point.
Yeah.
With my farmer hat on, I am much more concerned at this point with my corn than my beans, even if I had half acres of corn, half acres of beans, I'd be much more concerned about my corn. I think it's a very interesting situation. When we get into this August report, we talked about it a little bit. You know, I don't think guys are really going to look at the yield near as much as what they're going to be waiting to see what this acreage adjustment might be. I think that there'll be a lot to tell us in August. I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how many acres did we end up dropping? Because the function of the yield, Jackie and I talked about this before the show, you know, if we have 90 million acres and we extracted some of the acres that are maybe some of the poorer acres, that average yield is actually going to be a little higher. But if we stay at 92.3, which I do not think we will, I think the average yield will be much lower.
You know, it's interesting when you look at Landworth's numbers today, and I backfigured, they dropped their corn harvested acreage number by 900,000 acres. Mm-hmm. They didn't really change the beans, but the corn number changed a lot, and I think they've probably already accounted for a lot of the flooding issue on the Missouri River, et cetera. And if the one thing they can do really well, they really do a good job of pegging acres.
Yeah. I've said all along the most important number for the corn market is harvested acreage. Because this year, you know what, planted acreage is just kind of out there in no man's land. Nobody really knows exactly where that thing is going to come in at. But harvested acreage, that could be a real mind-boggling number for some people if they don't really get on the ground and see what we've got.
Yeah, that's absolutely the truth, you know. And it's going to be hard, especially along the Missouri River. You know, the flooding in some places is 6 miles into the land. You know, how do you figure that all out? Until we get further down the road. My question with the USDA report, though, is are they going to wait till the USDA report to announce the change in acres, or are they going to do it before? Because they can do it as of August 1st if they want to.
Here's some of the rest of the settlement prices that came in from the CME group, and I've got another topic I want to take up with you. September wheat this week, a top of $7.27 3/4, the bottom at $6.69 1/4. The September settled at $6.92 1/4. It was down 2 1/4. July wheat, $7.96 1/2, up 9 1/4. Live cattle futures at $110.55 were 5 cents lower on the week. The August feeders at $136.40 were down 70, and lean hogs at $100.82 1/2 were up $1.87 1/2 in Chicago. Earlier in this week, Jackie, they had a teleconference of sorts, a webinar, I believe, that they talked about changing the limits on corn. You participated, or at least listened to it.
Right.
They would like to change limits on corn so that they are now 40 cents and 60 cents.
Right.
I did read something, and I'm not quite sure I understand this, and maybe you can tell me, but it looks to me as if they do not have to have CFTC approval to actually do that, that it is possible for them simply to change the limit.
Well, that was not my understanding, and that's not what came across in the webinar. In the webinar, it was, we have to approve it at our level before we can go to the CFTC to get approval from them. But what they stated to us was that they had to have CFTC approval.
I kind of think that you're right, but I read a news article that was written in a different vein, and I wanted to check with you to see whether that happened. Who were the big screamers during that webinar?
Oh, my. Well, there were quite a few who were big screamers. I'm not going to name any of them, but people basically, FCMs and people like that who are in the clearinghouse business and are very concerned about the impact that higher limits might have on margin. And they came in, they had somebody who talked about margin, and they said that margin is not affected by corn limits. It's only affected by implied volatility, historical volatility, and unusual circumstances in the political arena and places like that, which I thought was rather ironic, because what do larger corn limits cause? Higher volatility.
You know, the one residing thought that I have about that, to me, the CBOT, now the CME, they've really lost sight of why we have futures markets to begin with. They're not there for the people to go bet on the price of corn or beans or wheat or hogs or cattle. They're there for people that are in the business to lay off risk. We have really lost sight of that in a lot of ways, and you can see the trend over the last 30 years in a lot of changes that have come about.
On that note, we'll wrap up this edition of Commodity Week. Our thanks to the panelists in studio. You just heard Dale Durkles of AgriVisor. Matt Bennett from TGM has been here, along with Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson. You can always find us at willag.org. I'm your host, University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You said we needed to talk about something else. What didn't we pick up?
You didn't talk about
quick
wheat.
Ship basis on corn. There's a big push for quick ship corn. I don't know. I just think it's an interesting thing, guys.
I also think.
See you later, Dale.
I also think this is an interesting thing too.
Oh, crude over $100, right?
Today.
And so, quick ship basis for the fall.
First half of SEP, and I think what you might see is. Prior to September 1st basis that is explosive. Yeah. And the only reason why I'm saying that is because we're seeing some guys, some of the processors step up and offer a quick ship bid that's as much as 40 cents over their fall bid. So, you know, September 15th to September 16th is a 40 cent difference up to, I think, the highest I've seen is 55 over their fall bid. And so I guess the one thing I would be looking at as a producer is, you know, if I planted stuff in early April, and even if I have spots here and there, if I've got 10,000 bushel that's worth 60 cents more, if I get it harvested on September 14th and maybe I pay 10 cents to dry it, that's definitely worth my time to go out there and get it out of the field. And I think guys need to be watching, especially someone who got whole fields that they didn't have to spot in, planted in early April with the kind of heat and the growing degree days that we've accumulated. We could be seeing prior to September 1st harvesting just like we did last year. And if we see that, you might see a dollar over the board.
Oh, that's, yeah, and I can possible. And I can back that up by just talking to you about what's going on out east and in other areas in the country. I mean, we're seeing spot bids at $1.60 when you go beyond Ohio. In Ohio, we're talking a dollar in a lot of places. We're talking 95 cents in Indiana for spot corn. And then as you come past, you know, of course, we've had a better spot bid here than what we normally would have. And you just keep going out to the west and it continues to be the same. So you know, what the cash market is saying is we need the corn and we're willing to pay for it. And so I think what the producer's job is to make sure he stays on top of what's going on in that cash market.
And am I right? And part of this, of course, is because of ethanol. But am I right that ethanol at this point doesn't really care if Washington takes away the subsidy, that it's the margins are good and they're going to blend one way or the other.
Well, I think a very important part of that discussion as well is the mandate. If the mandate's held into place and the mandate is stable, which it appears that it will
right,
be stable. But
I'm guessing the mandate will hold in place. But even at this point, remember, we're burning through more corn than the mandate requires.
Right. All I'm saying is I think it's more important that the mandate be stable than the incentive stay exactly where it is, because there are margins, very good profit margins, and I don't think that if they take a portion of the incentives away, I don't think that it's going to affect ethanol production anywhere near what people might have thought 6, 8, 12 months ago.
Well, and I agree with that, and I think when you look, I looked up yesterday, ethanol prices up 22% for 2011, and corn's only up 11%. You know, mm-hmm. that tells you that ethanol is profitable. You looked at we're at a record level for exports. And in April, we exported 52,000 barrels of ethanol to Brazil every single day. And so, you know, we had record exports to them last year. Dow Chemical's down there building the largest sugarcane ethanol plant, but it's not likely to bother us because of the fact it's going to be used sugarcane, and sugar's gone up 63%. So the idea that they're going to try and ship something back to us is extremely unlikely unless we see sugar really fall off. So I think when you look at the big picture, the question that I have in my mind right now is we're really pounding out the gallons. And are we doing that ahead of this credit going away? And what happens as soon as that credit is gone for a period of time? It might just have a short-term impact on us, but I think we're really hammering out a lot of gallons right now because of that, too.
Thanks so much for taking the extra time with us.
No problem.
No problem.